You're listening to Veterinary Vertex, a podcast of the AVMA journals. In this episode, we chat about how risk factors associated with vaccination protocols in dogs with our guest, George Moore.
Welcome to Veterinary Vertex. I'm Editor-in-Chief Lisa Fortier, and I'm joined by Associate Editor Sarah Wright. Today, we have George Moore joining us. George, I know you're super busy, so we really appreciate your time to join us here today.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity.
So, George, your manuscript in JAVMA discusses how breed, smaller weight, and multiple injections are associated with increased adverse event reports within 3 days following canine vaccine administration. Can you give our listeners background on canine vaccination protocols and risk factor information?
Yes, I'd be happy to, and certainly vaccination is really perhaps one of the most common preventive medicine functions that we perform in small animal practice. And in that, it has been helpful over time for our profession as it expands both in number and the types of patients that we have to provide guidelines or protocols. But we need, with an increasing number of vaccines available, help or some standardization, as it were, in that. And yet vaccines as immune stimulants also can provide some adverse events. And so the push towards this was related to concerns that I had regarding what might be most appropriate methods or protocols to be using in administering of vaccines to our small animal patients.
Thank you for sharing. This is some pretty important information. So glad we have you on the podcast here today. And what were some important findings from the study? I know it's hard to probably narrow it down, but what are the most important things you think our listeners should know?
Well, this study was actually a follow-on to a study of approximately 20 years ago. And therefore, people may not be aware that some of the protocols that are currently in place were influenced by that earlier study. Both this study and the previous study could not have been done without the help of collaborators at Banfield Pet Hospital, whose large number of practices, as well as electronic database, helped provide a large number of patients by which we could evaluate the occurrence and type of adverse events. That's a challenge in studying vaccine safety. We're looking for something that ideally is happening at an uncommon or infrequent rate. And so we need really large populations in which to evaluate that. And large databases are extremely important. Back in that study we did approximately 20 years ago and looked at about 1.5 million dogs, we had already determined that there was an increase in an immediate type hypersensitivity reaction in dogs. If you were administering a greater number of vaccines at that office visit, we also saw that there was an increase, we'll say, in smaller dogs. In this case, our cutoff seemed most notable at below 10 kilo or below 22 pounds, say below 25 pounds, that there was an increased risk for them. And then select breeds at that time identified as dachshunds, number one, and then Boston Terriers, pugs, minpins, chihuahuas. And then it markedly went down after that. Over time, we have been able to see both improvements through industry with safety of vaccines, the adoption into nationally and internationally published protocols about concerns for, at least in small dogs, limiting the number of vaccines that are administered at the office visit. And so we felt it was important to update to see if these aspects or other aspects have changed the risk factors within this safety window of 3 days and concerns for immediate type hypersensitivity. Specifically in this study that we've just now been able to get published through JAMA and just come out in the past week, we have still seen this increase with the number of vaccines, or one could say the number of vials that you're seeking to administer to the dog. Breeds still having some influence, the ones I mentioned still having some importance, but interestingly now, we have a new breed who's number one in not so much a good fashion, but French Bulldogs actually showed to have equivalent or slightly higher risk of an immediate type hypersensitivity reaction, even than Dachshunds. And so that was a bit of a new thing, a surprise. And with that, we were also seeing a slight adjustment, at least in this set of data in the weight, that there was now more of a distinction below 5 kilogram weight compared to what we had said before at the 10. The larger weight dogs still seemingly having no increase in risk of an adverse event, we'll say above 20 kilo. So that was encouraging that we still saw that. And then a secondary aspect that we were able to do with this set of data was to look at individual vaccines. And although people have certainly expressed concerns over time and or perhaps related to experience with safety of individual vaccines, might that be a distemper vaccine, a lepto vaccine, a rabies vaccine. In this study, we actually showed there was slightly more increase when you control for the other factors. The breed, number of vaccines administered, et cetera, we saw a slight increase, actually, that the vaccine, individual vaccine with the greatest, slightly greatest risk was the rabies vaccine. And we can come back and comment on that later, but it is supported by some other information that we've published in the American Journal of Veterinary Research in January, which acknowledges the presence of multiple proteins within the rabies vaccine that might explain that phenomenon.
Just for my own personal curiosity, when I was reading our manuscript, I saw that your study investigated adverse events recorded in greater than 4.5 million dogs. That's a lot of dogs. How long did it take for you to go through all that data?
You're right. That's a lot of dogs. And in fact, that was a lot of office visits, more than 16 million office visits. And in the period of window or the window of time that we had. And so that makes this just a phenomenal database as we look at that. But it also becomes a large database. I haven't normally had to do having worked in clinical epidemiology. Sometimes you have 20 patients, 30 patients, and so on. So there were times it took the computer longer to do its analysis when there's 4.5 million patients. The interesting aspect in epidemiology and that many patients and so on, and perhaps it's a reflection, as someone has said in life, that every time you win something, you lose something. That as we have more patients, we actually have less time and ability to scrutinize individual records. And so, whereas if I only had 20 patients or 30 patients, oh gosh, I can get into their medical records, I can get into details, but I can't do that in 4.5 million dogs. And so it provides a greater breadth. And now we have to use computer queries to look for spurious data, nonsensical data, dogs, for instance, that weighed over 400 pounds or something like that, which could have been a typo, an entry in typing weight. And so rather than just throwing these into analysis, if there are times in the cleansing of this much data that we may lose 1% of the data or some other aspects, but the rest of it looks very, very appropriate regarding size, distribution of data. And so it does take, sometimes takes a few weeks of looking, scrutinizing the data, but you're really having to do that electronically. You really can't go record by record, page by page.
Yeah, that is a lot of data. George, you're clearly, you know, you've referenced a couple of your other manuscripts, the key opinion leader in canine vaccination protocols. Way back when you started, what sparked your interest? Did you have an animal that had a reaction? Did you have a reaction? What sparked your interest in this? And then I can ask a second question. Tell me more about horses.
Oh, yeah. Happy to. I graduated from the University of Tennessee back in the 70s, which also meant that as a pre-vet student, I was working in mixed animal practice in Tennessee. And then subsequently, due to military, I was using military scholarship to pay for school. coming into the Army, where my first assignment had a small animal clinic that I could help in. And also, we had nearly 100 horses on post at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, whenever I was there. And it was actually a bit of an interest, although I had seen a vaccine reaction in a dog. One morning I was giving, we mandated rabies vaccines for horses at that time. And so here, this 1,000-pound horse was getting a 2cc rabies shot as far away from the brain as I could put it, which was back in the back hind quarter. And so one could think, all right, so the appropriate dosing of a vaccine as a horse is about 1cc for 500 pounds. Roughly, even though we don't dose it by weight. That afternoon, I had vaccine clinic in the military pet clinic, and someone comes in with a Rottweiler, big male Rottweiler. He weighs 120 pounds, and I give him a 1cc rabies injection back in the hind quarter. And in that, I'm thinking, well, so in a dog, is it 1cc for 120 pounds? And at the end of the afternoon, I have a toy teacup poodle puppy who's 4 months of age to get his rabies vaccine. And he weighs 4 pounds. And he also gets 1cc of rabies vaccine. And so I'm thinking between 1 to 500 pounds and 1 to 120 pounds and 1 to 4 pounds and so on. And just the curiosity that we've seen, and sometimes that's asked by people, that vaccines have not been tested across all weight groups. So that is an issue that is a separate discussion. But in regulatory medicine, it is across a species. And so in that, I began to wonder, might there be some difference not only in good events, protective immunity, but do I see anything in adverse events? And I did begin to notice certain breeds, and particularly in smaller dogs, adverse events. And then when I was able to move to academia after the military and investigate opportunities for research, an opportunity with Banfield hospitals, as well as investigating this aspect of vaccines, pushed me. On the horse side, which I really love because I've had a team of Belgian geldings, and I do like the bumper sticker, Lisa, that says a real horse weighs a ton. So with apologies to anyone who has minis or ponies and others. But that aspect of, while I wouldn't expect any concerns with full size or draft horses, certainly smaller horses, ponies or minis, miniature horses, are there an issue with that? We interestingly do not find many reports in the literature or even among practitioners of seeing an adverse event. But what I tend to think is a little bit the phenomenon is the aspect of why are we seeing an adverse event. I do think it can relate to, because we notice we said we were talking about vaccines or vials that were being administered, is that vial contains excipient proteins for manufacturing. And as it happens many times in canine vaccine manufacturing, bovine proteins, often from fetal calf serum, are a part of a canine product. And so it may be that part of the phenomenon we're seeing is a dog, a canine, reacting to a bovine protein, whereas on the equine vaccines, we are not using proteins that are seen as heterologous in that nature. And so that may be one of the reasons that we don't have as much an issue on the equine side. I think the bigger, personally, so I'll interject, to me, the part where I would like to see vaccinology move forward, not only on the canine side, but even on the equine side, is more studies on duration of immunity. Horses are generally longer lived than dogs. And so do I really need an annual vaccine, really, in this teenage horse? At what point do finally I have enough coverage. And the challenging part is we do have anamnestic cells. We do have memory. So I don't think it's always just the issue of a total circulating immunity, but certainly the question of an anamnestic response. Separate question for another day.
We could talk forever. I think it's really fascinating too. You know, I was vaccinated for rabies in 1987 in vet school, and at Cornell and academia, I had to be tested every single year, and I'm still immune. So what inspired you to do this follow-up study? And, you know, and then the dang Frenchies come out of it all. Is that because the Frenchies are more popular now, or do you think they're becoming more inbred? What do you think is going on with the Frenchies and what inspired you to really dig into this manuscript?
Well, I did hope and think perhaps there might be some changes in either influence, if we could, between the number of vaccines administered. I actually hadn't thought through the breed popularity aspect in the sense of the Frenchies as a breed that I would not have seen many of 20 years ago. I hadn't really thought of them specific because I didn't know that they were going to sort of raise their head in the midst of this. I certainly was aware anytime you have such a large group, you have to decide where to cut off the line. And in the previous paper, we had cut it at about 5,000 dogs. So for instance, at that time, there were no Wieslas, for instance, even in the table that we created for JAMA. In this one, because we have so many dogs and needing to keep the table at an appropriate length, we still had to limit it to the number of dogs that would be presented now over a five-year period. And it was more now, much larger, more in the range of 50,000. But now that did allow other breeds to show up, et cetera. Certainly, Frenchies are more common. Certainly, there may be an issue with inbreeding or less discriminate breeding. But the part that I find interesting that I really, really, really hope within the profession that genetics work and so on will take us forward is when I mentioned the breeds of interest that had come up higher at risk, French Bulldogs, you know, I mentioned Dachshunds, but also mentioned Pugs, Boston Terriers, and so on as we go through. In this top list, and actually the first large breed that will show up in the list is Boxers, it is striking the number of brachycephalic dogs that we have. And I realize that Dachshunds don't fit that. And I jokingly tell practitioners, I don't think that means that when you push the nose in towards the brain, it squishes mast cells together and they degranulate. So I don't think that's it. But what we don't know is tied genetically to traits and chromosomes, whether there is some other phenomena which could be related to vaccines. So if I could truly take in a test of French Bulldogs or Pugs, or even in Dachshunds, and compare vaccine reactors to those who are not reactors, what could I find genetically as a difference? So control for breed. And I'm really hoping if we move towards personalized vaccinology, that that would help really not only veterinary medicine, but might even help human medicine if one could find the gene or the trait that was tied to this immediate type hypersensitivity as it goes through. So I tend to think that's it. Now, again, that's a phenotype. That's a very important aspect. I made mention of it in the discussion. The owners report this as a breed, or the veterinarian or the veterinary nurse technician has put this down. And obviously, we don't have a genetic test. And one is learning that phenotype can sometimes be a fooler as to specific genetics for breed. There may no longer be purebred. But within that, I do think this is one of the keys is that genetics plays a major role in our response to vaccines.
Sounds like there's a lot of need for future research in this subject area.
Well, that's the nature of life as we life is busy. And as we go into these, it just keeps getting richer and richer, but more and more questions. But I think that's where, rather than striking, and sometimes there's a concern, we do like to generalize, but there's a danger within that. Even as we say things, we can't say, well, Frenchies have vaccine reactions. Well, Frenchies can, Yeah, vaccine reactions, toxins, can some. So we tend not to put qualifiers. So sadly, even in the media across, when we talk about human things and so on, people are lumped together, grouped together. And we just know there may be some increased risk one way or another with some of these phenomena, some small dogs, some breeds, and so on. And then the challenging question becomes, how do we apply this in protocols?
Always back to the clinical application, right, which actually leads me into my next question. So you have a lot of clinical experience. You're board certified by both the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine and the American College of Veterinary Preventative Medicine. How did your advanced training prepare you to write this manuscript?
Well, as it happened, in courtesy of the military, I would say, my initial work in the military was a type of general or mixed practice. I had an interest in large animals based on how I grew up and if there were horses on the military installation, but certainly was working with dogs. And then later in my career, much of my career with military working dogs. So my first 7 to 8 years were more general small animal practice. And then the Army paid for me to go through a small animal internal medicine residency at the University of Georgia, where I studied under Dr. Craig Green, who now retired, but writes the very thick book, Infectious Diseases of the Dog and Cat. And certainly that gave me an interest. And again, the military aspect, dogs deployed around the world, and what diseases do I need to protect them for? So thus the interest in infectious diseases, but it still became population medicine, thinking of this large group of dogs. And then with that, the opportunity to develop and earn a PhD in clinical epidemiology under a great teacher, Dr. Larry Glickman. And in that ability to apply the information, as we said, across populations to individuals. I do think good clinicians are good epidemiologists in general. We've taken information given to us in class based on a population. This is what generally happens. And we try to apply it to the individual, and most generally in small animal practice, N equals one. That's all I have on the exam table at that time. But with experience in practice, those ones start adding up. I start having a small group of animals with my giving me experience. And now I have to apply that to a larger group in the sense of making protocols. And what would I say and recommend to the next individual that we have? So all of them have been great experiences, and just even would encourage our young veterinarians to be thinking of these great questions still to be answered, and a focus not only whether it's in medicine or surgery, but to focus on the epidemiological aspects of why these conditions occur and what we can be doing to help reduce the incidence of adverse things and diseases, including disease, and how to improve care for our clients and our patients.
Thank you very much. So the next question is very important to our listeners. So let's say that you are in a small animal hospital and you see a small animal clinician that's about to go into an exam room to talk to a client about vaccines. What's one piece of information based off of the findings of the study that you would tell that clinician before they go and talk to their client?
Although I guess I could ask him to read the article. and one is a hard one to limit. The title certainly speaks of the major findings, how be they in general terms. They do mention breed, how be they. You have to read the article to know which breeds and so on. But I do think an important understanding, an umbrella, a lens to look through things as we do this, is still this understanding that there are two different ways of presenting and reporting and considering the information. That even though we will say in the article, based on logistic regression, multivariate logistic regression, comparative numbers, we are presenting a relative aspect on one hand. Certain breeds relative to other breeds can have 2 times the risk, 3 times the risk, 4 times the risk of an adverse event. Smaller dogs can have twice the risk compared to some large dogs. Yet those are relative terms. There are still the absolute question to concern, which actually we cannot, we don't have a crystal ball. We can't exactly predict whether the next patient will have a reaction. But even though we are giving relative amounts, the absolute risk remains very low. Vaccines are still safe. And maybe one way to compare that is if you buy a ticket, a lottery ticket, what is your chances of winning the lottery with one ticket? It might be one in 500 million. Well, you know, if you buy three tickets, you have three times the chance that you did have before. And so even though you've increased it relatively three times, it is still three in 500 million. And so we don't want the relative aspect to cause us to forget the there is an absolute issue here in the fact that vaccines are, by and large, very, very, very safe, even in small dogs, even in selected breeds and so on. And that although it could be prudent to limit the number of vaccines in the smaller dogs in terms of how many you are giving at one time, but that's been within the protocols now within the last few years, that it is still the fact that we should convey to the clients that in general, our vaccines are safe. In general, diseases are a threat and can be life-threatening. And we still would want to mitigate any potential chance of an adverse event. And therefore, we are electing to do such and such. I don't think we always have to administer an antihistamine or prescribe steroids and so on to take the risk away of an adverse event. But I think by and large, they are uncommon events. I understand they're dramatic. I understand they're very much instilled in the client's mind. I understand they can be influenced by other individuals, breeders, and others who have a skull and crossbones, no vaccines. But I think as we share that we vaccinate our own animals, that we need to protect, we have seen unvaccinated animals and they spend time in our hospitals, they may or may not come out. They spend money for the client. The best thing is prevention. It's still the ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure.
Yeah, thank you, George. You sound like my GP trying to talk me into the shingles vaccine.
And well, I still haven't. The people who've had shingles, they would talk you into it too.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, as I started by saying, like you're just the guru, the who's who, the key opinion leader, double boarded, 22 years in the Army, and thank you very much for serving. You clearly have resilience, determination, grit. Where does it come from, and what words of wisdom can you impart to our maybe younger colleagues?
Well, I'm not sure I have words of wisdom in that regard. I think we are, one person said, we're all prisoners of our own experiences. But I grew up on a farm. I grew up with hard work. I grew up with parents who went through much worse. They went through the Depression. They went through World War II. They had friends who died. My dad's mother, my grandmother, one of my two, she died in childbirth. And so people, I think, as we've had in life, difficult experiences, learning hard work, getting into vet school is hard work, getting through vet school is hard work. I would most certainly say hard is not bad. Hard is just hard. And in fact, you have to think about it with your bones. Too much stress on your bones will be a bad thing. But no stress on your bones will also be a bad thing. And so it's the phenomenon in biology in our lives, being in that balance. And certainly in the profession, we do struggle with work-life balance. But I think the idea of understanding that there will be challenges, we should persevere. And in fact, where does some push go? I mean, I think we can have an intellectual curiosity, and that can be driven a little bit by our background. Solomon, supposedly the wisest man in the world, says in the book of Proverbs, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter and it is the glory of kings to search out a matter. Now, I'm not a king, and I don't know that he was making a statement about funding of research and where where you have to have money to fund research. But, you know, it is a noble thing to try to solve problems, to not just accept things that are happening, the good and the bad, and just encourage people to look, to investigate. I know keeping up with literature these days is challenging too, but also to try to stay up on the cutting edge of things. And we can always improve the service that we provide to our clients and our patients.
Very well said. And just thank you so much, George, for your time today and for imparting your wisdom and your manuscript findings with our listeners.
You're very welcome. And most thanks again for not only allowing me to speak to this, but thanks again for the great help from my co-authors at Banfield Hospitals for allowing us to share this data and the findings with the profession. And we hope it will help people as they are prescribing and deciding in their protocols with their clients. Thanks so much.
And to our listeners, if you want to learn more, you can read George's manuscript on our journal's website and in print JAVMA. I'm Sarah Wright with Lisa Fortier. We want to thank each of you for joining us on this episode of the Veterinary Vertex podcast. We love sharing cutting-edge veterinary research with you, and we want to hear from you. Be sure to leave us a rating review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen to.